Well,
Thank
thank you.
you,
Billy, and hi, everybody. My name's Don. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm grateful to be anywhere, but I'm particularly grateful to be in an AA meeting in Virginia. Many of you know that I kind of consider Virginia my second AA home, and there's so many of you folks that I love and have been blessed with being able to see so many times, so thank you so much for having me. And Billy and I did a little texting prior to the meeting, and we came to the conclusion, or I came to the conclusion, that most of you all had heard my story, or many, many of you had, and some of you heard it ad nauseum. So we decided that tonight, instead of following the directions of talking a little bit about what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now, which I will talk about in the course of the other, but primarily I'm going to follow the directions that Billy read at the beginning of the meeting. I'm going to try to tell in my own language and from my own point of view how I've been able to form a relationship with my God. And that was a tremendous hurdle for me. My sobriety date, by the way, is April 9th of 1981. And my home group is the Calm Down Group. It's actually in southern Indiana, directly across the Ohio River from downtown Louisville. And we're two other guys, and I started that group 35 years ago, and I named it because it meets on Wednesday, and particularly by that time, at that time, by Wednesday, I really needed to calm down. And my current sponsor is my dear friend Bob B. from St. Paul, Minnesota, and I'm blessed with sponsoring a number of folks, and that's the lifeblood for me. I've been blessed with being asked to speak a lot and over the last nearly 40 years, and all that's great. I'm grateful to be able to do it, and it's a wonderful experience, but it's not what feeds me. What feeds me is sitting with one alcoholic, one-on-one, and going through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and seeing the miracle happen one more time, seeing that light go on, seeing the birth of hope that's been dead in us for so long. And that's what feeds me. In talking about my relationship with God, I first need to talk about the absence of one. I grew up on a tobacco farm in southwestern Kentucky, and I have no idea why this was the case, but it was. I've got a memory of sitting in Locust Grove Baptist Church, which was less than a mile down the road from our farm, around Christmas time when I was 4 years old. And I have a clear memory of sitting there still believing in Santa Claus, and not buying one word that preacher, Brother Lyons, was saying. And I don't know where that came from. I don't know if we were born alcoholics or not, and I no longer much care. I know I am one now, and I know what the solution is, and that's all I need to concentrate on. But I do know something was wrong with me early on. Not only that example, the first day of the second grade, when I was 6 years old, I went into the principal's office, Miss Fanny Wallace, and said, "Miss Fanny, I have been in a car wreck over the summer and have brain damage and can't be expected to do as well this year." And I just don't think the average six-year-old thinks like that. Go ahead. See, I set the bar a little too high last year. I need to jack this thing down a little bit. But at any rate, I spent the first 37 years of my life, and that's how old was when I got sober. I spent the first 37 years of my life as an evangelical agnostic. It was part of my mission to disabuse the superstitious of their superstitions. And I thought it was a mental a weakness of the mind and will to believe in such superstition. So by the time I got sober in April of 1981, and by the way, in case for those of you who haven't heard my story, I didn't come to AA because I woke up one morning and thought, gee, you know, it'd be nice to join Alcoholics Anonymous. I destroyed everything in my life. I destroyed it all. I didn't have any contact with my only child for over 3 years. I got kicked out of the law firm I'd founded. I got kicked out of the bar association, lost my law license. I lived for a year without an address. What I call living on the street in an expired Blue Cross Blue Shield card. Didn't sleep under the bridge, but the only reason I didn't was I could always get somebody to take me in, and it was often strangers. But at any rate, I had a hard time. And by the time I got sober, I had been in some kind of asylum, and about half of them were psychiatric hospitals, and about half of them were some genre of jitter joint, I guess. But I've been in those spots 18 times that I've been able to remember in the 2.5 years before I got sober. So I didn't come here just to make my life a little better. I came here because I had absolutely no place to go. Now, when I started going to those asylums, most of them probably had a program at least somewhat based on the 12 steps. And of course, the mention of God just—I was allergic to it. I would have a physical reaction; it'd make the little hairs stand up on the back of my neck. And as far as you guys talking about higher power, that made me even madder. I knew what you were doing. You're trying to backdoor me on that God trap crap. So the talk about God and higher power kept running me out of AA, and I'm so blessed that alcohol kept running me back in until finally in April 1981, the miracles began to happen. I had never asked a God for anything. I'd never acknowledged in my mind or otherwise that there was any such thing that had anything to do with my life. Now, I was okay with some sort of intellectual theory about a creative force, but as far as a personal God that had something to do with my life, I just completely and really kind of violently rejected it. So I hadn't asked God for a thing. But in April of 81, God started giving me the most beautiful, life-saving, and life-enhancing gift that I've ever had or ever will have. And that gift continues into this day. And it wasn't any sort of spiritual experience where I saw the light and my thoughts, feelings, and beliefs changed. It was nothing like that at all. My thoughts, feelings, and beliefs didn't change about a thing. Not a single thing. For the last couple of years before I got sober, there was only a little part of me that wanted to live. But that little part had figured out that the only outside chance I had of living was to somehow try to get this thing that you guys had. And I had really tried for a couple of years as best I could in the shape I was in to change my thoughts, feelings, and beliefs to make them more like it looked like to me. You thought, felt, and believed. And I was a total failure at it. I hadn't been able to change anything. And I only know that God began giving me that beautiful gift by looking in the rearview mirror. I didn't figure it out until 2 or 3 months after I got sober. I began to get an idea that something had changed that I wasn't capable of changing. And what it boiled down to was this. Without my mind changing about anything, for the very first time in my life in April of 1981, I began to follow some directions about how to run my life, even though, and I did voluntarily, even though I did not understand those directions. I did not agree with them. I did not think they would work, and I certainly did not want to do them. And I assure you that that gift, the gift of behaving better than I think, feel, and believe, is the only reason on earth that I'm here with my sweet Virginia friends this afternoon, instead of having been rotting in a pauper's grave for somewhere around 39 years. So I'm always glad for my story to carry this relationship with God. When I dragged back into the clubhouse in Nashville, the 202 Club, where they knew me well, I passed out in their AA meetings, and they had caught me in their men's room with illegal outside issues, warned their sponsors to stay away from me. When I stumbled back in there, I didn't think they'd let me in, but to my surprise, they did. I remember what was said and who said it. Harry Boyer, he'd been dead 30 years, I guess, said, "Yeah, come on in, Don, you're keeping us sober." And I said, "Would you tell me one more time what I need to do if I want to live?" And they said, "Sure, we'll be glad to. First things, don't drink, don't take, don't go to meetings." First 60 days, went to over 150 meetings. Had no idea why I was doing it. Didn't want to go to one of them unless I'd gotten feeling well enough. I was hoping I'd run back into some girl. My brain was still assuring me that you all were religious fanatics, and what I needed to do was get my head out of the sand, get my butt back to Louisville, get some money, a law license, a good-looking woman, a big car, be somebody, for God's sake. But part of that gift was being able to turn around in my brain and say, "Yeah, no, I agree with you. There's no way in the world that this infantile little silly program with their group therapy sessions they call meetings and their myth of a higher power can possibly solve our complex and unique problems. But we're just out of options. We don't have anything left to do. So I'm just going to go to the meetings and thank my loving God had it all back. I make it see without, and I've done that every day of my life without divine intervention. Without divine intervention, I make the ultimate reality about what I think, feel, and believe. And the truth is, my thoughts, feelings, and beliefs have never one time left a single footprint on reality. Now, if I abdicate my behavior to them, they leave a heck of a footprint. But in and of themselves, they do not. The only thing that's ever left a footprint on reality is what I said, or what I did. And during that same session in the 202 Club, when I stumbled in there, one of the things I was told was, "Don, you've had enough knowledge about Alcoholics Anonymous for over 2 years to stay sober the rest of your life without learning one single new piece of information." They said, "Dummy, what's killing you isn't what you know and don't know. It's what you're doing and not doing." And they explained that the big book wasn't a philosophy book. There's nothing in there I can learn or somehow master that'll keep me sober for a heartbeat. What it is a simple instruction manual for my actions. And so they told me I needed to go back to that like a little child and go with it. And then talk about the second step, because that was the monster. I could not find any shred of a belief in me that there was some sort of power greater than myself that could get me out of that humanly hopeless dilemma that we all accept we're in if we've taken step one, I believe, as properly. I think if we harbor any inkling that human help can take care of our problem, we simply have not done step one, and we're not ready for step two. But after telling me I need to go to the meetings, they told me that if I want to live, I needed to get on my knees every morning, every night, and ask and thank a power greater than myself. And I remember where I was sitting in the clubhouse, sitting there looking up at the steps on the wall. And I remember tears rolling down both my eyes as I explained to them what I just told you guys a few minutes ago, that I had really been trying for a couple of years to change what I thought, felt, and believed, and I couldn't change any of it. So the second step wouldn't work for me. It was what was killing me. But I was finally given ears to hear them. I'm sure they'd told me 100 times. But I finally heard them when they said, "Oh, Don, you've got that backwards too. We have never suggested that you think, feel, or believe anything." They said, "We'd never do that." Said, "In the first place, you're way too sick to have any valid thoughts, feelings, or beliefs. And in the second place, the issue of whether you live or die is going to be determined solely by what you do. What you think, feel, and believe won't have a thing to do with it." So they said, "If you want to live, we don't care what's going on in that old crazy picture show in the back of your head. You just get down on your knees every morning and night and say please and thank you." I remember tearfully nodding at them and thinking, "I'm not going to do that. That's the silliest thing I've ever heard in my life. Of course I'm not going to do that." But over my brain's loud veto, having no idea why I was doing it, not knowing that I had that beautiful gift of following directions, even though I didn't understand them, didn't believe they'd work, didn't want to do them, I found myself in the latter part of April of 1981, getting down on my knees every morning and every night, embarrassed, even though I was by myself. And as far as I was concerned, talking to the wall, asking something I did not believe was there to do something I did not believe could be done. But by the grace of God, I persisted. And I could count today, at 39 years sober, I could count the days that I've missed getting on my knees to ask and thank my God on my 10 fingers and have several left over, I think. And I don't know any other way to stay sober. When I began, I'm not a sponsor who tells people you must do this, you must do that, you must do anything. I'm really lucky to know where to take my next stitch. I don't claim to know what anybody else needs to do. But I do tell them not to ask me for any advice about how to stay sober without getting on your knees every morning and every night, because I don't have any experience in it. I was completely unable to stay sober without getting on my knees every morning and every night. And I'm not about to take a chance tonight or tomorrow by not getting on those knees every morning and every night. And the twin miracles, the second step happened. The first miracle is that when I began to take the action consistent with the person who really had gotten the second step mentally, that they really had come to believe there was a power greater than themselves that could get them out of that hopeless dilemma of step one. When I began to be happy they had done that, I got the twin miracles. The first one is that I began to get all the benefits of being a believer. And of course, the second one was that as a result of persisting and getting down there and saying those words that I didn't think could do any good to something I didn't think was there, I came to believe. And faith found me. So it turned out that, and this was to my absolute shock, but it turned out that for me, finding belief and finding faith were exactly like everything else in my life. Never one time in my life have I been able to successfully think my way into right action. Anything right I've done, I've had to act my way into right thinking. So when I began to take the action consistent with belief and faith, it began to find me. Now I will tell you though that by the time I was 3 or 4 months sober, of course, like any newly sober person, you got a whole lot of things spinning around your head. And I'd be so obsessed with something, so scared that I was down there trying to pray. I couldn't remember the last word. I just tried to pray. You know, it was perfectly clear to me.